Well, let's get started. Thank you for coming to our physics talk series. Today, we're very excited to invite back to Wichita State University one of our own alumni. Originally, Steve Coleman was a student here and graduated in 1982, then went off to Purdue University, where he worked on his PhD in particle physics, and went to Argonne National Laboratory in particle physics, and now he's going into the realm of particle astrophysics or dark energy, dark matter, using some telescopes. So he's going to give us a talk about surveying the ideas behind dark matter and dark energy in the universe. So let's welcome him back.
Into optical astronomy and cosmology. As Nick said, we had a couple of detours along the way. So the first one was particle physics, and so I spent about 20 years on particle physics on the CDF experiment at Fermilab. And in 1994, there was this Newsweek article, which was after the evidence for the top quark. And a year later, the discovery was claimed. And I am right there. At some point, I decided to... was somewhat tired of particle physics, to be honest with you, and always... wanted to do astrophysics, and so we dipped our toe into this, and I know that there's a lot of activity on the Pierre Auger Observatory around here, and we actually worked on Auger North for a while, went to Lamar, Colorado a couple of times, but the main contribution that we did in this time period from 2003 to 2007 was to calibrate or help calibrate the air fluorescence detectors in the Auger experiment, and I won't have time to explain that here, but what happened was Argonne had three very good accelerators to do this calibration for the nitrogen fluorescence properties, and this is a spectra that we took and recorded in like 1 minute at one of those accelerators. This is the nitrogen fluorescence lines, and the nice thing is the intensity and the resolution was so good, you could do this, change the pressure, do it again, change the pressure. And so we did an enormous mapping study, humidity, temperature, pressure, and published that in a series of five papers. And this was called the AirFly Collaboration. So we had a lot of fun there, but in 2007, we moved into optical astronomy and cosmology, and that's very close to starting over. That world is really different. Language is different, and it really is very close to starting over in graduate school, which it has its pros and cons. But it's been a lot of fun. So the experiment I'm working on is called the Dark Energy Survey, and this is providing a new 570 megapixel CCD camera for an existing telescope in Chile, and I'll talk a lot more about this. And the Department of Energy and the National Science Foundation, in exchange for handing over this camera, is going to get 525 telescope nights over a five-year period to do whatever we want with them. And the main goal here is to study dark energy, as I'll describe. Here is our current group here at Argonne National Lab. I have two postdocs, Rahul and Kyler. Joe Bernstein was my original postdoc. I'll talk about him. He has a position at Argonne in a different division at the moment, in the computing division. And then staff members, Eve Kovacs, Hal Spink, and Rich Talaga. and our engineers, Vic and Alan, have done a tremendous amount of work for this. So what do you see here? First of all, this is the Cerro Tololo Inter-American Observatory. I saw you had a poster up for one of their REUs here. It's a wonderful place to do astronomy. Here the star is in northern Chile. And this is inside the big dome here. This is a 4-meter telescope. And so the light comes down, bounces off here, and it has two modes of operation, as most optical telescopes do. You have the prime focus camera, which is this black tube here, and you have a mode where you can put a secondary mirror in front of that camera, and the light bounces back down this black tube down to the Cassegrain cage, where you have secondary instruments. And I'll actually show you that secondary mirror. So the idea is this very old black camera is being replaced with a modern version. And please interrupt with questions. I should have said that. I'd much rather have dialogue here. So just a brief outline, once again, motivation and description of the survey, the telescope, the camera, and the science. So here is a couple of pictures. So this is on the site at the observatory. And I always get asked, so this is the Milky Way, large Magellanic Cloud, small Magellanic Cloud. And I always get asked, does it really look like that? And so two things. One is, you know, 20-second exposure with the CCD is a little better than your eye, even after being outside for an hour. But your eye is pretty close. It's really bright and spectacular. It's just a stunning view. On the other hand, these Magellanic clouds are actually blue, and so you don't get that here. So it's even better by eye, I claim, than this picture. And I've made 8 trips to this observatory, and I plan them around the phase of the moon so that I can see this picture every time. This is a dust map, and it's an inverse dust map. So darker here means less dust. So the idea is that we're avoiding the Milky Way. So this is a dark energy survey. We're trying to go very deep in redshift. And so we're trying to avoid the Milky Way at all possibility. And so this area here is our service area, survey area, essentially avoiding the dust of the Milky Way. Okay, just a little bit of an overview. So this is a joint DOE-NSF project, around $40 million, around 120 scientists from 4 countries. The first collaboration meeting was in 2003. Argonne joined in 2007. And the camera has been delivered successfully to Chile. It has been retested. And they are now tearing that telescope apart to install it. And first light is supposed to be this August. So coming up very quickly. Josh and here are the project leaders. So the camera, as you'll see, is sort of a hexagon. And the idea is that you have, like in one tiling of tiles in 1 year, you get a pattern like this. And then you go back and do it again so that you're getting overlapping sections. And so you can calibrate the photometry of the instrument over time with overlapping measurements. So just a picture, I'm over here. This is not, doesn't look like 120 people. I was a little surprised at how few people seem to be in this picture, but there are, this was in La Serena, Chile, which is the headquarters for CTIO. Okay, so now what's the motivation for this? The first one is a new and improved Sloan Digital Sky Survey. So this is a picture of the Sloan Telescope in Arizona. This was about an $80 million project, an extremely successful sky map. Most sighted ground or space-based observatory there is, over 50,000 citations so far. DES, since it's using an existing telescope, is a lot cheaper. It's going to use a larger telescope. The CCDs are much more red sensitive, And the mapping, it's actually good that there's very little overlap with the previous survey. So we're getting more of the sky mapped. The second motivation was to provide redshifts for the South Pole Telescope. So this is a large telescope at the South Pole that's run by the National Science Foundation. And the nice thing here is galaxy clusters can be measured independently by DES and South Pole Telescope, and they will they provide complementary information. So just a bit of a glossary. You probably don't really need to read this. So ORA is the NSF manager for various observatories, including NOAA, which is the National Optical Astronomy Observatory, which operates the telescopes at Kitt Peak and CTIO. And CTIO, I've already discussed, it operates those telescopes, including the Blanco. The Blanco is named after one of the early directors of CTIO, Victor Blanco, and it is quite old. It was commissioned in 1974 for about $5 million, and it has a twin telescope called the Mayall at Kitt Peak. And even though it's quite old, it's a very well used telescope, and 90% use last year, and a factor of two more requests were not met. During a 2-minute exposure, it locks in the guide star and maintains that to 0.2 arc seconds, and one of our pixels is 0.7 arc seconds. So this is a wonderful telescope for this. This is the announcement of the opportunity to use that telescope in 2003. And now some pictures. So this is me. This is the telescope. And this is when it was being built. You see somebody up here with looks like no safety harness, as far as I can tell. So this is quite a facility. And then I like this drawing of what it looks like on the inside of the dome with multiple layers. And okay, so motivation four is the science. And as you know, it appears our pie chart is not very complete. We seem to understand this little sliver here, this yellow part, which is the normal matter. And maybe we don't even understand the neutrinos all that well yet. But here we think roughly a quarter of the pie is dark matter, and the rest of the energy density is dark energy. And one of the main things here is if dark energy, as I'll talk about, is just due to a cosmological constant, that is fine. You know that Einstein had that in his equations at some point, and by default, it's not a surprise to have vacuum energy. And the problem is that the particle physics theory predicts too much by, depending on which theory you're talking about, at least 60 orders of magnitude. So particle theorists are happy if there's no vacuum energy because there's some symmetry that cancels it, or a lot. And we have just a tiny bit. And so this is one of the biggest discrepancies in science between theory and measurement. Okay, so now on to the camera. I think I've already shown you this pretty much. So this is the initial lens. So it's a 5-lens optical corrector. And this is the first lens here. It's a big camera, weighs 3 tons. This is, I mentioned that secondary mirror. This turns out to be the largest project that Argonne took on, was to handle and align this mirror because it's different than the previous camera. So this is actually the mirror here. This is the reflection of this person here. And there's a lot of earthquakes in Chile. I think it's the busiest place for earthquakes on the planet. And so you have to be able to align this. You have to have a system that aligns this to better than 300 microns and is robust enough to handle earthquakes. even at the worst times. And so that was an engineering thing that Argonne took on and has completed. Here is the camera, fully loaded with 74 CCDs, and the different colors are different levels of anti-reflective coating here. The CCDs were developed at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. They're much thicker than your normal CCD, and so they're very red sensitive. And just to highlight that, and so we normally will run with four optical filters with labels similar to the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. So G is sort of the blue, R is a little redder, I and Z. And these were, you know, some simulated filters. We have real filters now, and they actually are quite good. They have a very good top hat response. You know, this was a fake, but the real ones actually look a lot like this. This line here is the quantum efficiency of the CCDs, and down here is the quantum efficiency of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey CCDs. So the thin CCDs are much worse than the red, and this big jump here in the red band is one of the main motivations for this measurement. So just a couple of slides on some things that we did at Argonne. We did some sort of bench tests. So Argonne has this beautiful synchrotron radiation facility called the Advanced Photon Source, and they have a lot of nice facilities. So we took a test tour over there and tested some of the DES CCDs there, and using an X-ray tube plus a 5-micron tungsten pinhole, we were able to get essentially 1 pixel beams of X-rays there, and then with stepping motors, step across the focal plane. And so here is one of the things that we did was, this is now the beam sort of in the middle of the CCD, and you can see it's roughly 1 pixel. But as you get towards the edge of the CCD, the electric field gets distorted, and we actually map this out and publish this. And this makes a big difference for the science, because I'll describe these very subtle lensing effects. And there's a lot of gaps between CCDs, a lot of edges in the CCDs. And so it's going to be pretty hard to have galaxies that don't touch the edge of the CCD and have some kind of a distortion like this. And so the lensing group has used our measurements to help correct their simulations and prepare for real data. So this is one of the little things we did. Okay, and now I believe the rest of this is on science. Okay, I'm actually doing... So I should maybe pause here. Any question about the instrument or anything else on the experimental end before I jump into science?
I have a quick question. Mm-hmm. You say there's this, if I understand you correctly, there's this big difference between the theoretical and measured mm-hmm. vacuum energy, if I'm saying that correctly.
Yes.
I understand I'm not an engineer, not a physicist.
Mm-hmm. Fine.
I thought for a long time there was some question whether or not they calculated the vacuum energy correctly or not. So are they more comfortable now with the theoretical versus the practical measurement of vacuum energy?
So, I mean, I'll get into this a little bit more. Maybe I'll answer your question as I go through the science. I'll talk about other possibilities.
Okay.
But I believe, you know, this 60 orders of magnitude here,
yeah.
This is using, you know, the latest supersymmetric models, which of course supersymmetry hasn't even been found yet. Now, you know, what's happening, you know, at the highest scales, or you know, nobody really knows. I mean, I think at some level, you know, the theory is going to break down eventually, but this is, you know, the best they've done.
Okay.
That's now there are. Yes. Yeah. Sure.
Go ahead.
Could you define? Could you explain the connection between looking for dark energy and redshift?
Yeah. So once again, that's in my science section.
Okay.
That's coming
so
up.
We're on our way.
Yeah. Okay. So the
Slide 18, please. Okay. So how are they going to find field correct for that?
So we have a flat field calibration screen.
Okay.
And this is the old one.
Okay.
The other way to use the Sloan Digital Sky Survey stars. So you've got thousands and thousands of well-calibrated 1% stars from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. So you can just move your telescope there. And so the plan is every night, whether at the beginning of the night or the end or both, you do that as well.
Since you know the difference in behavior of the detectors, you can map them.
Yeah. Okay. But, you know, during the day, you can do this kind of a calibration with a laser system. And they have monochrometers. Okay. So now on to the science. And I thought this was amusing that Ira Flatow in 2008 declared dark energy as confirmed. And this was based on some X-ray data of galaxy clusters. And I would just point out here that the term dark energy is a little misleading. It's usually meant for the vacuum energy. That's usually what people talk about. But the only thing we really know or believe is that the expansion of the universe is accelerating. And that's what the evidence is. And whether that's caused by vacuum energy or something else is a different matter. So here's kind of a cartoon just to set the scale up for the science. You define the omega here as the density of whatever it is, divided by the critical density. The critical density is the matter density that's required to halt the expansion of the universe, and so if everything was matter. So the idea is that in a flat universe, all of these omegas have to add up to 1.0, and in this plot they don't. It's more of a cartoon. The bottom line here is that this red line, which is 30% matter and 70% dark energy, you see the expansion. This is the relative size of the universe versus time. Now is here. And so you go back 13.5 billion years to the Big Bang on the red line here. And you can see that the expansion is growing. And this is, I'll show you the data that leads to this red line in a minute. So I think, you know, I would say the favorite option for this is the cosmological. The simplest option is that there is some vacuum energy. But like I said, we have this factor of 10 to the 60 discrepancy with theory. And on the other hand, you know, it's quite possible, say here for number three, that general relativity on the largest scales needs modifications. You know, why not? And so the challenge is to separate these three. The second one here would be some kind of new particle physics, new scalar fields, Higgs-like, and maybe more importantly, inflation-like. So we believe the universe went through an inflationary period right after the Big Bang, and that's driven by very heavy scalar fields. That's the common model of inflation. So at some level, you could say that we still have inflation. That's what dark energy is. It's accelerating the expansion of the universe, and why isn't this just a different form of inflation? So I kind of like that idea. But right now, we don't know which of these three options it is. And that's one of the goals for the Dark Energy Survey. So just a little bit. This is, from general relativity, what the expansion formula would be, where A, once again, is the scale factor, the size of the universe relative to now. And you have four main terms, the matter term, which goes like essentially like 1 over the volume. You have a radiation term, which is very small now. A flatness term, which is very close to zero now. And then you have this dark energy term and this W parameter, which you get talked about. And so that's the pressure divided by the density. And for a cosmological constant, that's equal to -1 precisely. And so the -1 cancels the +1, and you're just left with this omega dark energy term. So the real question is W equal to -1 if it's a constant? And is it a constant? Is it time dependent? And that, if you could answer those really well, for example, these scalar fields would very likely be time dependent. And the favorite models, you either start off with a lot of dark energy and it decays away, or you start off with a little and it grows. It's very unlikely, if it's some new scalar field, that it's a constant in time. And so the time dependence would really point you in that direction, and obviously you would get rid of the cosmological constant option. Modified general relativity is very model-dependent, and so that's going to be a little harder to determine. But like I said, these are the big questions that we're trying to answer. Okay, so just a couple other general comments. The microwave background measurements plus the Hubble constant measure this amount of dark energy extremely well. In fact, this is an old number. It's better than that now. But this is just a snapshot right after the Big Bang. It doesn't give you a time dependence. If W is a constant, then and we knew that for sure, then we probably know the number is pretty well, to like 6%. And it's centered right at -1. So it is, if it's truly constant, it seems like it's going to be the cosmological constant. But if you allow the fits to have a time dependence, then this gets a factor of 3 worse. And a common parameterization is the total W is the current value plus some A dependence times 1 minus A. Couple other comments. So modified gravity is unlikely to explain dark matter, which I haven't talked about too much. But since the effects vary over very wide scales, but there's certainly no reason why we couldn't have particle dark matter plus modified gravity and no dark energy. So that's certainly a perfectly fine thing to pursue. There was a task force set up by the Department of Energy to help rank future experiments, and this was before the Dark Energy Survey was approved, and Dark Energy Survey was sort of the result of the Dark Energy Task Force ranking, and they sort of won the competition for now. And the focus was on the evolution of W. And so their figure of merit is the inverse area of the error ellipse in WA, W9. Okay, so now that was kind of the big picture. Now I'm going to go down into a little more the techniques that we're using to see these things. So there's 4 main techniques to probe dark energy. And I'll discuss 3 of the 4, the baryon acoustic oscillations. BES is not really competitive with other probes, and so I will leave that out of this talk. And I will start with the one that I work on, and is also the most mature, and that's supernova. And so here is an example supernova explosion. This is the galaxy, and here is a single star out on the outskirts. And as you probably know, that supernova explosions many times are as bright as an entire galaxy. For type 1a supernova, the conventional wisdom is that you have a white dwarf that accretes matter from a companion star. And I'll just point out that this conventional wisdom is being seriously challenged now by the model that you have two white dwarfs that are colliding. And that's how many people now think type 1a supernova are created. I'll just point out, redshift of one supernova exploded 8 billion years ago. There's a lot of variation in their absolute flux, but you can do a correction that improves that. I'll show that in a second. And so you typically sample a supernova field every 5 or 6 days. Okay, so once again, some definitions. What is the magnitude definition? Absolute magnitude is if the object's at 10 parsecs. And what is the distance modulus? Two definitions, the observed magnitude minus the absolute, or the distance in these units. And here are some supernova. Here's the absolute magnitude. These are type 1a supernovae. And so the brightness is goes up to about minus 19.5 absolute magnitude. And the thing that you notice here is a thing called stretch. And this is the thing that makes these supernova useful for cosmology. And that is that the brighter ones, which are up here, are also broader. And so you can use one parameter to do a correction and make all of these supernova look alike. And that was what was done here. Now, it gets a little more complicated when you have dust and things like that. But the basic idea of these kinds of supernova is that you can turn this huge spread in brightnesses into something that's manageable. And once you know the absolute brightness and you measure something in your detector, you basically know how far away it is if you know the red, if you know the redshift. And so one more slide on the basics, just repeating the definition of the distance modulus here. So you see these numbers from 37 to 45. Where do they come from? So the observing limit for DES is roughly 24th magnitude. And actually for supernova, it's closer to 30. But here, the default survey is like 24. The absolute magnitude of the type 1a supernova is minus 19. And so the distance modulus observed minus absolute, 24 minus minus 19 gives you 43. And so you can see versus redshift, the distance modulus, and that basically up to about a redshift of 0.6, the DES supernova will be completely measured well. There will be no there'll be no corrections. You're going to be 100% efficient for all those supernova out to redshift of 0.6. Now going beyond there, you have to do some corrections. Okay, so now here is a similar plot of distance modulus, and I remind you that dimmer is up on these plots versus redshift. This is essentially the dark energy discovery supernovae. And if you look down here, where you've taken the difference between essentially the theory and the data, this dashed line here on the bottom is what you get with no dark energy. So the fact that these supernova out here are above the line and dimmer means they're farther away. And therefore, the universe has expanded farther than what you thought. And so that's the evidence, the original evidence in 1998 for dark energy. Now, it's gotten a lot better since then. That was a couple of dozen supernova. The current data has 580 from a lot of different experiments. and you get these contour curves. So this is now the amount of matter versus the amount of dark energy, and you get these contours from supernova. This is from the microwave background, and this is from the baryon acoustic oscillations. And this line here is if you have a flat universe, and so you can see that things are converging at these values. So this is the pie chart. This is where the pie chart comes from, essentially, that you get the 73% omega lambda, and this is now the atoms plus the dark matter, so the leftover 27% is in matter. And then you want to go one step further and look at this parameter W, which is the one that's going to tell you whether dark energy is a cosmological constant, and you get this ellipse here that is even within one standard deviation of minus one, and also omega matter 0.27. So this is where the field is sort of at the moment. The idea is to reduce these error ellipses and see where things end up. Okay, and so our group has focused on the supernova science within DES. Like I said, my first postdoc, Joe Bernstein, has moved into a different position now, worked on this for a long time, and in fact, I just learned from him yesterday that this paper, which is sort of defining the supernova strategy for the dark energy survey, was accepted by the Astrophysical Journal. I'll show a few plots from that. So the first one here is, where are the supernova fields? And so these dots are the supernova fields where we're going to spend extra time inside the DES area. And these are fields that have been sampled by other experiments quite a bit. And we ended up actually with 10 fields. There's only 5 dots here. These are our favorite 5 dots. And I believe the other 5 fields are sort of like adjacent to these 5. And the idea is that we're going to probe 2 deep fields with 2 hours of exposure time each visit. And those visits are like every 5 days. And that will have 8 shallow fields with 30-minute exposure time each. And we're using a software package. We're sort of co-developers with Rick Kessler at the University of Chicago on this simulation package called SNANA. It does a lot of, it's not simulating a full supernova explosion. It has parameterizations for these things. But it does a lot of the corrections. It applies galaxy dust, Milky Way dust, weather history, sky noise due to the moon and the position of the moon. So the simulation is among the most sophisticated for supernova science. And here are some light curves. It may be a little hard to read. So I repeated this slide here. So these are the 4 filters, G, R, I, and Z, and the wavelength ranges. And so the left panels here are the G band, so 400 to 550 nanometers. And the top 4 plots are redshift 0.25, so that's on the low end. And then you go redshift to 0.5, redshift to 0.74, and obviously the redshift is moving light to the redder bands out here. And so G band actually drops out pretty much by redshift of 0.74. And now you look in R band and I band, which is here, and Z band. So this is sort of the data quality that we expect for the supernova in the dark energy survey. One thing to note is type 1a supernova have this second bump, which is a characteristic of how the opacity changes in the explosion. And this is actually in the models. The people that model supernova explosions can predict this second bump. And so this is a parameterized version of it, But the science of that is actually well known. Okay, just a couple other plots from this paper. So I mentioned that the cosmology right now is being done with 580 supernova. So we're expecting around 3,500. And we are, this histogram here is what's coming from the deep fields. So that's what's giving us our high redshift supernovae. And this dashed histogram here is giving us the statistics down at lower redshift where we can do more calibration and understand the systematics of the supernova better. And just a quick word on the cosmology variations here. Once again, this is the same distance modulus versus redshift plot, the Hubble diagram, as it's called. And here is the difference with theory. Here's our expected statistical errors and a variation of the cosmological constant here of 10%. So this does not have systematics, which are, of course, the most important thing, but just to give you an idea of the statistics. So now, sort of putting the four techniques together, I'm going to come back and talk a little bit more about galaxy clusters and weak lensing in the next few slides. But this is kind of the bottom line plot that we're looking for. So you have the W0, which is -1 if it's a cosmological constant, and 0 if it's a constant. So the time dependence on the y-axis and the W0 on the x-axis. And you get the four techniques here. The green is the supernova. But the bottom line here is the size of the red air ellipse in the middle, that the inverse area of that ellipse, this is all 95% confidence level air ellipse. So DES is almost a factor of 5 improvement over current knowledge in the inverse area of that ellipse. And the thing that is interesting to me is this rectangle shows a region where some of the theories for new scalar fields, such as from string theory, would come from. Here's one reference. Actually, this is a nice summary paper if you want to get a quick view of these kinds of models. And so what I think is interesting is, gee, what happens if this red air ellipse ends up over here at the corner of the blue triangle? So that would be incredibly exciting because, number one, you're translating this way, so you would no longer have a cosmological constant, right? You would be many standard deviations away. Whether you have a time dependence here or not would not necessarily be known in that case. On the other hand, you would have some idea of chasing down these theories, and that would give some guidance as to what dark energy might be. So this is, to me, the goal of the DES is, you know, does this red air ellipse end up in the boring place, which is in the middle? Yes?
So are you saying that string theory is actually made a prediction that's testable?
I'm saying string theory produces scalars that could do this.
Okay.
All right. That's not quite the same statement.
It's
not quite the same statement. Okay? Okay, and so let me talk a little bit about these other techniques. But that slide was kind of the bottom line. And I wanted, before I confuse things with these other techniques, I wanted to get that slide in, because that, to me, is really the bottom line for the DES. So here are galaxy cluster counts. And here, each square here is a projected optically identified cluster. We expect around 170,000 optically identified clusters. And about 20,000 of them will overlap with the South Pole Telescope. So I mentioned that was one of the main motivations. And I don't really need to go through this too much, but the idea is that the microwave background gets affected by galaxy cluster gas, and the photons scatter in that gas, and it changes the spectra of the microwave background. So that's what the South Pole Telescope gives you. The DES gives you the redshift for that cluster. So you look at the same cluster and in two different ways, and the systematics really drop out. And here you can see some curves with different amounts of dark energy in them. So this is one of our better techniques. The other one is weak lensing. And so I'll have a couple more slides on weak lensing. The idea here is, you know, you have some mass, usually dark matter, and you have galaxies behind the mass, and the lensing of the distortion due to general relativity of the light from those background galaxies tells you sort of the matter distribution, not only radially, but in a transverse way as well. And so you essentially get a 3D map of the dark matter with this technique. And now I have a little animation here. Yeah, isn't that great? So this is a cartoon of what, if you had some big mass in the middle and all the galaxies were perfectly round, what lensing might look like. But like I said, this is a cartoon. I'll show you this is a real image from the Hubble Space Telescope. It's one of the best lensing examples. So you have a very massive galaxy cluster, 200 trillion solar masses, that's also nearby, redshift of 0.2. And I remind you, the Milky Way is about a trillion solar masses. And so all of the background galaxies that are farther away than this galaxy cluster are being lensed, and you can see some Einstein rings here. It's one of the most beautiful examples. But what the DES is really going to do is more of what's shown here, and that is you do a coherent analysis of all the background galaxies, and you get what's called the shear. And so basically, these little lines tell you how much a galaxy at that point would be stretched and in what direction. And so the galaxy cluster is centered here in the middle, and if you had a background galaxy here, it would get stretched like that. And so this is a real publication, a real measurement using that galaxy cluster that I showed you in the last slide, and this is the shear map, as they call it. And so based on that, you also get a mass map. And so this is the mass distribution of that galaxy cluster. And you know from redshift measurements that it's at redshift of 0.2. So here you have a map in the transverse range of the mass and at one slice in redshift. You now take that and you do that to 300 billion galaxies all over the sky, and you get this 3D map of the dark matter. That is one of the best techniques to study dark energy, and that is one of the main goals of the experiment. Okay, so a quick summary. I think dark matter and dark energy are among the most compelling mysteries in science, and high energy physics is spending more and more money on this because of that. And the Dark Energy Survey is really the first Department of Energy, high energy physics major project in this area. And it's a relatively small experiment, but I think it's going to have a big impact. And in the works is the next generation experiment, which is about 15 kilometers away from DES in Chile, on a mountain called Cerro Pachón. And this is an artist's conception of what it's going to look like and what the telescope would look like. This has initial approval from both the Department of Energy and the National Science Foundation, but it's at least 8 years away if we're lucky. But this is the next big thing. It essentially does everything 10 times better than DES. That's it.
Well, we have some time for discussions and questions. I guess the first comment I'd like to make is that Wichita State University's Physics Department is known for producing some really great scientists, and I'm just really impressed with Steve's talk and him showing another example of a really great physicist that our physics department has produced, and we thank you for your talk.
You.
Questions? Discussion? Ideas?
Give me a hint to this without requiring any honest work, but if suppose one of these models, like a scalar field, accounts for the acceleration of expansion, do they understand how that would correct quantum field theory or learns on the decimal places?
Oh no, then it's different. So then you go back to zero vacuum energy. You throw out the vacuum energy model. You say there is no vacuum energy. And so then the particle theorists, well, they wave their hands and they say, oh, there's some symmetry to make it go away, but they're at least happier. Okay. And so you replace it with the scalar fields.
But it's still a quantum field theory. Now there's, besides the standard model, there's this extra scalar field thrown in? Or?
Yeah. Now whether... Right. So then, the question is whether, how that fits into the standard model of particle physics and the default quantum field theory for that. You're right. But, I mean, it's definitely new physics. It's beyond the standard model of particle physics.
Is there, I'm sure there's some reference to talk about this.
I think the one I showed you is a great place to start. It's a four-page PRL. Caldwell and Linder is a fantastic place to start.
Other comments and questions and ideas?
I appreciate a comment on the density of black, the density of black matter, and also any further observations about the form that you expect it to take.
So dark matter, I believe, it's about 1 GeV per cubic centimeter. But that is dark matter. Dark energy is much less. So dark matter is, of course, discovered in the velocity curves for galaxies. So, and of course, this has been known for about 50 years, that the star velocities look like this line B, if you measure them, and it's been measured in many galaxies. And if it was just stars and no dark matter, you expect A here. And so this discrepancy gives you the dark matter. And this is something called the Bullitt cluster that was more evidence for that. But this is very consistent among all the galaxies that you measure, and you get about a GeV per cubic centimeter of dark matter. It seems to be everywhere.
Now, sorry, the discipline on this issue, do we have a measurement for our own galaxy in regard to dark matter?
Yes.
And is it consistent with what you're measuring?
Yes, we do. And I didn't throw a slide in. There's a nice paper just a few years ago. I believe the name is IOCCO. It's an Italian group. The lead author is IOCCO. I should have thrown in a picture of that. So they have measured this, and they've also done modeling. And this is quite typical of what's in the Milky Way.
Do we have any idea how it's phased from the Milky Way?
How it's phased?
Yes, we're sure.
So distributed. Well, I think
the dark
only
energy,
only
the dark matter. I mean, the dark matter located throughout, or is it?
It's throughout. So the model that best fits is essentially a spherical halo. So that the galaxy you have a basically disk, and that the dark matter is essentially a sphere surrounding it.
Surrounding.
Yes. That is, so they were able to fit the Milky Way's curve, and most of the galaxies are like this, the best way to fit the data is to have a spherical halo of dark matter.
Is it uniform or one over R?
It's actually what's called an NFW profile, so I think it's steeper than one over R.
Other questions? Poker?
So you now have about 500 supernovae, and you want to increase that by a factor of 7 or so, and then with the next project go up another order of magnitude. Mm-hmm. How many more supernovae are out there if if your instrument can improve indefinitely, when will you run out of statistics anyway?
So the LSST, the LSST could record millions of supernovae. So it's really how much area are you covering? And the DES were just those 5 or 10 circles, and that's 30 square degrees. And LSST is going to cover 20,000 square degrees every week. So, and that's essentially the cadence that you want to find a supernova, like a measurement every 5 days. So it's really like 20,000 over 30 is how many more LSST will record. Now the question is how well they're going to be measured. They're not going to be as well measured as ours. And that trade-off between poorly measured and statistics, it's not clear who's going to win in that case. But there are supernova, if you have enough volume, there's no lack of statistics for supernova. They're going off everywhere.
So are you also increasing the maximum redshift?
So LSST, the ones that I'm talking about, will actually not be as high of redshift as what we're doing. So we're actually going out, because we have these very deep fields, we're going to be going out to higher redshift than LSST. So it's a different optimization. So LSST supernova, they're coming for free. So the survey is going to do this mapping every week, no matter what. That's just the survey. And so, and they're doing that for other reasons as well. And so, in our case, we're taking part of the survey away from the main survey, and so we had to optimize our time. And so we've optimized only these 30 square degrees to do the best cosmology.
So then I guess there's hope to eventually even go beyond just linear time dependence. And are there models that differentiate between higher orders?
Yes. Yeah. So these, even in this 4-page PRL on the scalar fields, they talk about the time dependence. So those models. Sometimes, I mean, they even have oscillations in some models where the dark energy goes up and comes back down. But most of them are either, like I said, you either have a lot at the beginning and it's just decaying away, or you have a little at the beginning and it's growing. That's the two main classes of those models. And so those have very different
time dependencies, as you can imagine. Other questions? I'd like to remind everybody, we are next week is Janice McKenna talking about CP violations. She's going to be talking about that in the B Corp sector with results from both the Stanford and the KEK in Japan experiment. Let's thank our speaker again for a wonderful talk.